And this is the operator. I'd like to inform all participants today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. If you need further assistance, press star zero for an operator. You may begin.
Thank you very much. So welcome to the November 2010 Charm Telecon. Our speaker today is Professor Odette Aronson, and Dr. Aronson is a professor of planetary science at California Institute of Technology, Caltech, here in Pasadena. His past research is focused on Mars, Martian geology, and the record of climate variations. And on Cassini, he's involved with the Cassini radar team, and in particular mapping surface features on Titan. And his presentation is going to focus on the distribution of lakes on Titan and the implications for climate cycles, similar to those at Earth. The title of his talk is Unveiling Titan, a World Strange and Familiar. So, Dr. Aronson?
All right. Thanks a lot, Marcia. Before I begin, I want to let you guys all know that actually I have four first-year graduate students who are taking my class here at Caltech that have also joined us. When we are sitting here next to me, they're having this instead of their class. So, welcome. The story I want to tell you is indeed about Titan and about the lake distribution, but before I really get into that, I want to sort of set the stage for how this process of discovery and exploration of a new world took place over the last few years. And I know you guys have been friends of the Cassini mission for a while now, so you probably know a lot about what I'm going to say. But bear with me. There's probably some people who don't know and some people who do know. Before launching into it, I want to acknowledge the contributions of several people who without whom this work wouldn't be possible, the most important of which is Alex Hayes, who's my graduate student here at Caltech. There's a few more people on the title slide that are listed. There are a list of prestigious names, including Charles Alaki, who's, of course, the director of the lab with the radar instruments, that the results of which ones that I'm going to be discussing. All right, so what you see on the title slide are two projected images of the radar swats that have been acquired by the Cassini spacecraft mapping Titan. And you see these swats are acquired every time the spacecraft flies by Titan. The spacecraft is, of course, in orbit around Saturn, and every time it flies by Titan, we point various instruments on at Titan and collect data. So that's why these things look like strips. because they're acquired one at a time. Before Cassini got there, I'm going to move on to the second slide. Before Cassini got there, we actually didn't know very much at all about Titan. We knew it was a very interesting place, and most of what we knew was from remote observations from Earth, either from Earth's orbit or from the ground on Earth. And this is what Titan looks like from orbit around the Earth. This is an image from the Hubble Space Telescope wide-field camera, and you see, I think, quite aesthetic view of Titan casting its shadow on Saturn. So Titan is over there on the left, and the shadow is right on Saturn. And you see that Titan looks basically bland, orangey color from Earth, and that's because Titan is veiled with clouds and hazes, particles that obscure the surface from the eyes of most instruments. So this is more or less the picture that we had of Titan for quite a while. When Voyager passed by, Voyager 1, and I'm moving on to the next slide, when Voyager passed by, it took some closer-up images of Titan. It was still seen to be a hazy world. It had some clouds on it. We could see the clouds from Voyager. And in particular, the clouds already then were recognized to be asymmetric. So the North Pole would seem to have had a polar hood of clouds, and in different seasons, those clouds move around on Titan. So the kinds of analyses that we could do were really restricted to some theory and some experiments that we can do in the lab. There wasn't very much that we could tell about Titan. We could tell some things about the atmosphere, its composition, and its density profile from the Voyager flybys. But really most of the thinking, I think, was either theoretical or experimental. And people were trying to figure out what could this atmosphere be made out of and what gives it this orange color. and experiments like the one you see on the right side of the slides that took place in my alma mater at Cornell, experiments like that attempted to synthesize particles by subjecting nitrogen and methane or and other hydrocarbon compounds to radiation, to UV radiation, corona sources of energetic particles. And when you do that, you form ever more complicated nitriles and ever lengthening chains of hydrocarbons that when they stick together, they form this muddy, goopy stuff that that Carl Sagan, I think, termed the word solen to describe, and solen is Greek for muddy. So the idea is that you're making this gook, essentially, and in Titan's atmosphere by lengthening molecules and making them stick together to form particles, and those are at least some of the particles that are present in the atmosphere that make it difficult to see the surface. These are the hazes. Those particles become larger and heavier, and presumably they fall down on the surface, and it was thought that they would coat the surface with a similar material if we were to ever land on the surface. So this is what we knew then, but I think now, really, as we're exploring Titan, we realize that its place is really much more among the terrestrial planets, and I'm moving on to the next slide that shows Venus, Earth, and Mars to the right of Titan there. So these are planets that have atmospheres, that have cycles, they have geologic and in some cases hydrologic cycles on them. And I think Titan is really a nice world of comparison that fits within those worlds much better than among the typical siblings, the icy satellites in the outer solar system. The icy satellites in the outer solar system, although we are now finding out, have more geologic activity than we had initially expected, given their very low temperatures being so far away from the sun, Titan is really special among that family because it has an atmosphere and because it has these hydrologic cycles that I'm going to talk about. So everything changed, and I'm moving on to the next slide. In October 15th of 97, well, it actually took a little while for things to actually begin changing, but in October 15th of 97, Cassini launched, and you guys are probably all aware of this spectacular event that was photographed, I think, by our this was not an official photographer. I think this is just some guy taking a picture of the Cassini launch. So Cassini arrived at Titan a few years later, and Cassini is made up of two components. One is the main spacecraft that you see imaged here, and the other is the probe that was released and entered through Titan's atmosphere, and that's called the Huygens probe. And Europeans were the ones that were responsible for the Huygens probe, and they're very, very proud of the incredible success that Huygens has had. I'm moving on to the next slide that's titled The Magnificent Seven. So here I'm indeed comparing Titan to the other icy satellites in the outer solar system. You see Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto there, the Moon, and Triton, I think, probably is on the bottom, and then Titan. And you see these are actually drawn to scale, and you can see that Titan is among the largest of the icy satellites. And, in fact, in the beginning, it was thought that it was the biggest one because if you look at starlight passing behind Titan, which was how the sizes of objects is typically measured, the light is attenuated by Titan's atmosphere. So when you count the atmosphere, Titan is actually the largest satellite, and people thought that it was the largest satellite until they could see a little bit deeper through the atmosphere and realize that the surface is actually a little bit further down. So Titan is no longer the largest one, the second largest satellite. If you go on to the next slide, one of the first results from Cassini, I think that I want to emphasize, is the incredible spectral diversity that was observed on this satellite. So there was an instrument called VIMS on board the spacecraft. You might have heard some talks about the results from this imaging mapping spectrometer. And when VIMS looked at Titan, what was realized is that Titan has multiple geologic provinces on it. Some of them are bright colored, high albedo. Others are darker, low albedo regions. And the spectrum, which is here indicated by just a color composite, also varied from region to region. So this was the first clue that Titan wasn't a simple, icy, almost dead world, but rather involved geologic processes that varied from place to place on the surface and that results in materials that vary in composition. By the way, I want to emphasize, I don't see your faces, so I can't tell if you're making funny faces at me or not, but if you can help me figure that out by asking questions while I talk, that would be great. So if you go on to the next slide, you'll see the dunes on Titan. This is the second, if you count the title slide, of a set of radar images that I'm going to show you of Titan's surface. And before we actually talk about the dunes themselves, I want to explain how this instrument works. So Cassini had on board the synthetic aperture radar, which works in much the same way that SAR works on Earth, by pointing a radar antenna off to the side of the spacecraft and illuminating the surface with radar energy. And then that energy reflects off the surface. Because it's looking off to the side, much of the energy is reflected away from the surface off to space, but some of it is reflected from the surface. If the surface is rough, some of it is reflected back to the spacecraft. So I hope you guys can all imagine how that works. Imagine pointing flashlight or something and onto a rough surface. Some of the light is going to bounce off, especially if the surface is smooth, and some of it will return back to you, and you can see what you're looking at. So these radar images are acquired by the spacecraft flying by and pointing its radar antenna off to the side. And what makes something radar bright is if it is rougher, first of all, then there's more energy that has the opportunity to scatter around and come back to the detector. Or if the surface is sloped, and in particular, if it's sloped towards the spacecraft, so there's more chance for the energy to reflect directly back from a sloping surface, directly back to the side-looking antenna. Or if the dielectric constant, if the electrical properties of the material are such that it is more effectively reflecting the energy back to the spacecraft. So those are the things that I want you to remember when you're looking at bright, dark variations in radar images. Either it's rougher, if it's brighter, it is either rougher, sloping towards you, or it has a different dielectric constant. So now if we go back to looking at these dunes, you can see this is actually a mosaic of a couple of images here. And you can see that, especially on the left-hand side, you see these longitudinal dunes. These are fairly long, a couple of kilometers spaced apart, and a couple of hundred meters in height dune forms that whose slopes are facing, at least one of its slopes is facing the spacecraft. So when you illuminate it with radar energy, a large fraction of the energy returns to the spacecraft, and you can see the highlights on the dunes with one side being brighter than the other. So this is the first of the geologic forms that I'm going to show you that are all too familiar from our own experience as geologists on Earth. These are, on Earth, longitudinal dunes are actually not very common, but especially not large sets like this. Most of the time on Earth, if you have long structures of dunes, they tend to be transverse dunes, dunes that form in a direction perpendicular to the wind direction. These are actually forming in a direction parallel to the wind direction, and you can see they even wrap around and deflect around topographic perturbations, so topographic obstacles on the right side of the image. So there's some hills there or mountains that the dunes wrap around.
Question, please?
Yes, please.
What distance did you say the horizontals were between each other and how long they were?
So the dunes can be tens of kilometers long, and the distance between them is maybe 1 or 2 kilometers.
Great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking. So this is the first example of the kind of geologic feature we sometimes see on the Earth, but frequently see on Titan. And it's the first example of, when you really think about it, you know, we traveled all this way across the solar system. We went to a place that is 10 times further from the sun, receives 100 times less sunlight as a result of that, and we start finding geologic landforms that are familiar to ourselves. So a place that is at once strange in terms of its temperature, in terms of the materials that are involved, and this theme will come up again and again, but also familiar in terms of the resulting geologic forms that we see there. So to highlight that, if you go on to the next slide, the one titled Linear Dunes in the Namib Desert, this is a picture with the same sort of scale of dunes taken from the one of the astronauts just pointing his handheld camera out the window of the shuttle and taking a picture of the dunes as they flew over them in the Namib Desert. I was actually just out in the Sahara a few weeks ago, also looking at longitudinal dune sets in analogy with the Titan dunes that we find. So there are a few places on Earth where we have large-scale longitudinal dunes, but because they're uncommon on Earth, understanding how they form both on Earth and on Titan is a very interesting question. How they form, what climatic conditions allow them to form, and how do they evolve and migrate?
Question regarding dunes for Max Cornell.
Please.
Sir, are there any plans to conduct radar change detection missions to determine whether these dunes are changing? Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. In fact, we are very, very busy looking at just that. We have multiple images of the same spots on Titan. And near the end of this talk, I will show you some examples of some features on Titan that are changing. However, you have to realize that the radar images that we have of Titan are a few hundred meters at best in resolution. So the dunes have to change a lot in order for us to detect any differences in the images that we have. So we're trying to do that, but I think it's going to be pretty hard to see changes. We're also, by the way, trying to do that on Mars, where we have sub-meter per pixel, 30 centimeter per pixel images of dune fields, and I think those we do see changing. Okay, if you go on to the next slide, please, you'll see a slide titled Titan's Hydrologic Cycle, and this is one of the most important take-home messages that I want you to remember out of this talk. The first one was, here's a world that's so strange, different temperatures, different materials, and yet it is remarkably familiar. The second point is outlined here on the slide. So what you see here is on the y-axis is the atmospheric pressure on the left on Titan and on the right on Earth, and on the x-axis is the temperature at that location. And if we start with the black curve, the one for the Earth, you see that there are various temperature inversions in the Earth's atmosphere. The temperature goes down and then goes up again as you go up in altitude. And near the surface and also at other places in the atmosphere, at other heights in the atmosphere, there is something special that happens in the Earth's atmosphere. And that special thing is that the temperature and pressure conditions at those locations are near the triple point or near the phase diagram of an important substance that's abundant on Earth and in the solar system, and that's water. So much of what our experience on Earth, almost all, I would say, of our experience on Earth and our very existence on Earth is due to this very important fact that the Earth's atmosphere, temperature, and pressure profile crosses the phase diagram of water, allowing the opportunity for water to evaporate, precipitate, rain down, and form a hydrologic cycle that drives, as I said, almost everything we can see on the surface of the Earth. The remarkable thing is that an exactly analogous thing happens on Titan. So on the left is the Titan temperature and pressure atmospheric profile, and that profile, too, crosses the phase diagram of an important substance, but it's not water. As you see, it's a couple of hundred degrees colder than Earth. The Earth's surface is, you know, near 300 Kelvin. Titan's surface is near 100 Kelvin. It's actually more like 90 Kelvin. So there is a substance that's 200 Kelvin, that's volatile at 200 Kelvin colder temperature than water. And can anyone guess what that is? How about my graduate students? Can anyone guess what this is? Methane, yeah, that's right. All right, so methane is volatile at 90-something Kelvin, the atmospheric temperature, and at the atmospheric pressures on Titan. So methane has the opportunity on Titan, much like water on Earth, to evaporate, precipitate, rain down, carve channels, and form lakes. And this is really what I'm going to focus the rest of the talk on, is this remarkable consequence of the methane hydrology on Titan. So if you go on to the next slide.
Sorry, could I ask a question?
Of course.
I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the differences in pressure between the Earth and Titan, because Titan is smaller, but it's much more dense, or the pressure seems to be higher for the same profile.
Right. So Titan's surface pressure is about 1.5 bar, 1.5 times the Earth's atmospheric pressure. So it's similar, or maybe just a bit higher than Earth's atmospheric pressure. So it's, you know, it's sort of similar. It is smaller. Mars is a bigger object than Titan, but its atmosphere is 100 times thinner than Earth's. And Venus is the same size as Earth, weighs about the same, and its atmosphere is like 100 times thicker. The pressure at the surface is 100 times higher than Earth's. So what you should learn from these random facts that I just listed is that mass is important because the object needs to be large enough to hold on to its atmosphere. But it is really not the determinant of atmospheric pressure. What determines whether an object, I think, has an atmosphere is really the budget of volatiles or of gas that can be released to that atmosphere and the rate with which it is lost from that atmosphere. So Mars may have lost some of its atmosphere to various processes like hydrodynamic escape, like impact stripping. Apparently, the Earth hasn't lost all of its atmosphere, or at least it was rejuvenated if it were lost. Venus held on to a lot of its atmosphere, or perhaps it continuously rejuvenates it from its interior. And Titan held on to about as much atmosphere as the Earth did, and it, too, actually, is likely to rejuvenate its atmosphere from processes in its interior. And I can tell you a little bit more about that later on, let's hold on to that thought. But your question is a good one. Titan is smaller. How come it has an atmosphere? It's big enough to hold on to it, but really what matters is the extent to which gases and volatiles in general are released to the atmosphere and the rate at which they're lost, not just size. So if we go on to the next slide, you see a radar image again of a set of channels on Titan. So I told you that there's opportunity for methane to precipitate, and indeed it does. It rains down, and there are several places on Titan where we see that this supply of liquid from the atmosphere drains and forms channels. The channels merge. Sometimes they form sinuous forms, very similar again to Earth channels, and they braid, as do Earth channels. They merge together and form drainage basins where they pool. So all of these geomorphic signatures are ones that we also see on the Earth in terrestrial channels. And here is an image that was taken from an airplane window by a friend of mine, Ralph Lorenz, as he was flying from Tucson to L.A., as he does, I think, very frequently. And you can see if you flip back and forth between the channels, I think Ralph also had this picture in mind from Titan when he took the picture of the channels near Parker, Arizona, because they just look so similar in terms of their anastomosing, braided, sinuous forms. Okay, so I mentioned to you that Cassini had a component that was called Huygens that was separated from it when we arrived at Titan. And if you play the next movie, is everybody able to play the movie? Can people see the movie? Everybody is muted. Okay, I hope you're seeing the movie. What you see there is Huygens being separated from the spacecraft, and the spacecraft, it has an initial angular velocity. It's spinning a little bit in order to give it some stability. It enters Titan's atmosphere at hypervelocity speed. There is very intense heating that a heat shield is required in order to protect the spacecraft when it comes in through the atmosphere. And then there are a set of parachutes that deploy in order to slow down the spacecraft and to separate it away from some of the hardware that's no longer necessary. You need several parachutes to accomplish this. You don't just land with one parachute on Titan, because parachutes that are big enough to have an effect at the very thin atmosphere would make the spacecraft drift down too slowly when it is landing in the high-density part of the atmosphere. So all of this sequence has to happen completely automatically, because Titan is too far away to joystick the spacecraft from Earth. So all of this has to be programmed in advance. And eventually the last parachute deploys, the spacecraft acquires the surface with its instrumentation, slows down, and touches down. And you have to understand, back when all of this was happening, we didn't know what we were going to land in. I mentioned to you that there were ideas about solids covering the surface. We knew that there was a lot of methane in the atmosphere, and that methane was near its triple point, so it might be liquid. So some people wrote papers that said that Titan might be covered by global oceans. So this lander was designed to be positively buoyant. In case it landed in liquid, it could float. And we really didn't know what we were going to land in. So we had to design the spacecraft in a sort of true exploration spirit of not knowing where we were going to end up. And if you go on to the next slide, the one titled Titan's Odds at Caltech, you'll see that on landing day, this was the whiteboard in the kitchen around the corner from my office at Caltech. We were taking a betting pool on what it is that the Huygens probe was going to land in or on. So you see on the left there were several people who thought it would land in just ice. We knew that Titan was cold and that water is abundant in the solar system, so maybe it would just land in water ice or other kinds of ices. Several people thought it would land in tar, in this muddy stolen stuff that rains down from the atmosphere. Darren thought he would land in liquid, in either in a lake or in part of this global ocean that was hypothesized. A lot of people thought that we would never be able to determine what it was that we landed in. We would be able to take pictures of it maybe, but we won't know what it is. I guess my student shares my skepticism, and he thought he would be dead on arrival. And then a very famous Caltech professor over on the right thought he would be eaten when it landed. What indeed we landed in, if you go on to the next slide, is this view that you see on the right-hand side. This is the view from the Huygens lander. This is one of the very first pictures the spacecraft took when it landed, and this was spectacular. I mean, I remember the excitement when this thing was beamed down to Earth. What you see is a field that's covered by boulders, some of which are somewhat rounded, and that look, again, remarkably familiar to some scenes from the Earth. And to give you some context, the images on the left are the ones that were acquired by the descent camera when Huygens landed. And you see a set of valley networks that, again, merge and collect to ever-increasing in width trunks of river channels, riverbeds, that ultimately empty down into a basin. Now, the spacecraft, the landing site, is actually not in this image, but it is further down in that drainage basin into which the channels drain. And this is important context, because you can easily imagine that some of the ice boulders, presumably ice boulders, we never measured them directly, but I think that's what they are, that you see in the image on the right, were delivered to this field by the transportation that occurred in this channel. So these boulders could have rolled down in the channels, carried by the fluid that carved the channels, most likely methane. And as a result of this process, they were rounded to form these these sort of centimeter to decimeter, tens of centimeter size boulders that are somewhat rounded that you see on the right. So, again, a world so far away, 10 times further from the sun, 100 times less sunlight, 200 degrees colder. Ice is as hard as rock at those temperatures, and the liquid is methane. And we see geologic landforms that are strangely familiar to our own. If you go on to the next slide, the cartoon, this is really kind of a summary of the picture that should be building in your head about what Titan is like. So what you see here, again, on the x-axis is temperature, on the y-axis is the height in the atmosphere. And in the cartoon, you see various processes that I have already discussed that must be occurring on Titan. First, because the temperature and pressure profile cross the condensation point of methane, we expect methane to condense in the atmosphere and to rain out. So we expect to see clouds. We expect to see rain. Higher up in the atmosphere, we get these hazes that I already discussed, and that could also fall down and rain down on the surface and coat it. When the methane rains down, it forms channels. The channels pool and form lakes. And in addition, I already mentioned this earlier, there is likely to be some contribution to the atmospheric hydrocarbons from the interior of Titan. So because the lifetime of methane is short in the atmosphere, methane breaks down because of the photochemical reactions that I mentioned earlier. So because it breaks down over a relatively short time, there is no way that the methane that we see in Titan's atmosphere was around for 4 billion years. So there must be some mechanism by which methane in Titan's atmosphere is rejuvenated. And one such mechanism might be cryovolcanism. That's also a cartoon near the bottom of the slide there. So there may be ice volcanoes on Titan that re-release some of the carbon back into Titan's atmosphere. And this is, again, should be very reminiscent from the Earth, where we have a carbon cycle. Carbon form carbonates in the bottom of the ocean, the plates of the in mid-ocean ridges emerge and then are resubducted at subduction zones. And in this way, carbon works its way back into the interior of the Earth, where it has the opportunity to become volatile and re-released in volcanoes. So the Earth, like Titan, has a carbon cycle. And in Titan's case, it is probably accomplished through fire volcanoes, although that has not yet been detected. So this is a hypothesis on my part. Okay, so if you go on to the next slide, and for the remainder of the talk, I think I want to talk about the lakes on Titan. So we mentioned that the methane has an opportunity to rain down, drain, pool, and form lakes. And indeed, when we looked at Titan with some of the very first passes that Cassini flew by Titan, we saw lakes. The lakes were detected using multiple instruments, in the infrared, for example, and using the ISS instrument. But here what I'm showing is a set of lakes or a few lakes that were detected using the radar instrument. And if we focus our attention for a second on the top right panel, the one that's marked dark, this is what most lakes on Titan look like to the radar. Okay, and you see they're very radar dark. So from the explanation that we discussed earlier, why would lakes on Titan be dark? The answer is that, if you recall, the antenna is pointed off to the side. So it illuminates the lakes with radar energy. And if the lakes are made of liquid, therefore they are smooth, then most, if not all, of the energy bounces from the lakes off into space. And very little of the energy is returned back to the spacecraft. So that's why most lakes on Titan are either entirely or almost entirely radar dark. And in the panel on the left, the top left panel, you see the North Pole of Titan with all the radar passes that we had at that time superimposed, and the blue region filled in are my student Alex Hayes' attempt to map out the distribution of lakes in the northern hemisphere of Titan. So you see some of them are small, some of them are larger, some of them are even form connected seas, such as over on the right side of that panel. I said most of the lakes are radar dark, but then on the bottom right panel, you see something that looks just like a lake in terms of its shape, its size, its sort of lobate, sort of rounded off edges, like the dark lakes in the top panel, but it's radar bright. So this was a puzzle when it was first detected. I think we know now what these radar bright lakes are. I think what they are, they're empty pits that were formerly filled with methane, but now they are dry lake beds. And I have some support for that. First of all, they're radar bright because they're not smooth like the liquid that fills the filled lakes. And secondly, in a few cases, the same instrument, the radar instrument, can operate as an altimeter. The way that works is when the instrument bounces the radar energy off the surface, it actually measures the time of flight of each pulse, how long it took each pulse to leave the antenna, bounce off the surface, and come back to the antenna. So this is the altimeter mode, and from the time it took light to travel from the spacecraft to the surface and back, we can get how far the surface is, and if we know where Titan is and where the spacecraft is, then we can get the topography. So on the very bottom panel of the bottom left figure, you see an altimeter pass right over one of these bright features. So on the y-axis is the topography, and on the x-axis is just distance along the ground. And you see that right when we pass over one of these bright lake features, the altimetry shows that that feature is a couple of hundred meters below its surroundings. So these bright lakes are actually pits in the ground that are a couple of hundred meters deep. So that's important because, first of all, we now see that there are dried-up lakes on Titan. And second, and I want you to remember this, that these pits are a couple of hundred meters deep. Are there any questions about that? Okay, the next slide shows you a movie of a very prominent lake in the south of Titan, actually. I told you that most of the lakes are in the north, but this one happens to be in the south. And this is an animation that was made jointly between JPL and the USGS. The lake is called Lake Ontario, and as we're flying around this lake, you can see the details of the shoreline of Lake Ontario that we actually published in our recent paper. As you fly around, you see that the shoreline has different morphologies in different parts of the lake. So parts of the lake shorelines are smooth and look like they're erosional shorelines. As we're coming around, I'm not sure exactly where you are in the movie, but as you come around to the other side of the lake, you can see that there's actually a channel that empties into the lake and forms a delta where sediment is deposited in the lake. So this is, again, very reminiscent of terrestrial lacustrine systems where sediment is being delivered by channels and then falls out of suspension when the fluid rapidly decelerates as it hits the lake. And then near the tip of the lake, I'm not sure if you saw it when we panned around, but near the tip of the lake, you see a shoreline morphology that looks like tectonic control. So there are mountains that are abut the lake shoreline. So again, this is classic geology from terrestrial experience, where you see all three classic type of shorelines represented here on Titan: an erosional beach form, a tectonic bounded shoreline, and a depositional shoreline.
So the animation ends with a view of the delta, right?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay.
if you go on to the next slide, you see another what I think is a very aesthetic view of Titan. And this is light that's actually reflected from Titan from the sun. So this is the camera, that took a picture of Titan from Cassini again. But in this case, you can see the specular reflection of the light from the sun against some of the high latitude, northern latitude lakes, and that is then bounced straight to the spacecraft, this light. And those of you who fly over the ocean will certainly recognize the specular point that you always see this glint. There's a place on the ocean where the angle of incidence is just equal to the angle of reflection, and from the airplane you can see that a reflection of the sun in the ocean. That's exactly what you're seeing here on Titan, with light reflecting off the lakes. So what are these lakes made out of? If you go on to the next slide, you'll see a paper that was published in Nature where a group analyzed some of the spectral information we have from the lake. And what they concluded was that the lakes have a component of ethane in them. Now, I already said that there's much methane in the atmosphere. Most of the atmosphere is actually nitrogen. As I say, it's about a bar and a half of nitrogen with a little bit of methane in it, and then even smaller amounts of higher hydrocarbons like ethane and propane and other things. But most of the atmosphere is nitrogen and methane, so it is difficult to see through all that methane that's in the atmosphere. If we look through the atmosphere, we can only look in places where methane is transparent. The methane molecule is transparent. Otherwise, all we're going to see is the atmosphere. But there are a few windows like that in the methane spectrum. And when we look through those windows, we're not going to see methane on the surface because we're looking through methane windows. We're going to look through in places where methane is transparent. So it's going to be very hard to detect methane on the surface, even if it's there. But what we are going to see are other things that have spectral features in those windows. And in particular, what Brown et al. Saw was that the surface's lakes have a component of ethane in them. Now, how much of the lakes is ethane versus methane that we can't see is not yet known, but I think it's a very important question. But what's sure is that Lake Ontario, the very same lake that I showed you the animation of, has some component of ethane. Okay. If you go on to the next slide, you see projected the North Pole of Titan on the left and the South Pole of Titan on the right. And again, in blue are all the filled lakes that we have been discussing. So you see the North Pole has a ton of filled lakes, and the South Pole has this one prominent Lake Ontario that we've been talking about, and maybe a couple of other smaller lakes. But what's clear is that there is a great abundance of lakes in the north and a deficit in the south. And I think this is a great puzzle, and the puzzle didn't emerge all at once. The way this map was acquired was one radar path at a time. So I want you to imagine the process that we went through, where we flew by the northern hemisphere and we flew by the southern hemisphere. We saw one lake in the south, and we started flying by the northern hemisphere more frequently, and we saw more and more lakes in the north. And every time we flew by the north, we saw more lakes and more lakes and more lakes. And then we had a flyby of the southern hemisphere, the South Pole, and we saw it didn't have very many lakes in that pass. And then there was another one and another one. And it took many months and even years to build up this picture of many lakes in the north and very few lakes in the south. But I think today it is pretty clear statistically that there are many more lakes in the north than in the south. And the initial idea is that perhaps this dichotomy in lake distribution, the great abundance in the north and the deficit in the south, is a statistical fluke. That's no longer likely. There are so many more lakes in the north that I don't think it's likely to be a statistical fluke. Even if in the beginning we didn't have enough data to prove that, I think now the coverage that we have, as you see in this chart, really demonstrates that the lake distribution in the north is much more abundant. And if you go on to the next slide, the one that has the histogram on it, the blue lines indicate the aerial coverage or the fraction of area covered with lakes. And you see that in the north, there is tens of percent in some latitudes of the area that we sampled is covered with lakes, whereas in the south, it's only a few percent. So there's maybe a factor of 20 or more difference between the northern and southern hemisphere abundance of lakes, at least polewards of 55 degrees in each hemisphere. And the dashed line shows you that we covered a good fraction of the surface in both hemispheres. So that's the dashed line. It should be read with the right-hand axis, and you see that we covered somewhere between 40 and 50, 60% of the surface in both hemispheres, both high latitudes. So we can't use the excuse that we just haven't seen enough of the surface and all the lakes are hiding in places that we haven't looked at. There really are more lakes in the north per unit area than in the south. So what could possibly explain this? And this is really what I want to talk about for the rest of the time. The first idea that was suggested, as I said earlier, was that this is a statistical fluke. But we said, yeah, that's probably not likely now that we see this much of the surface. The next idea was that maybe there's something different about the topography of the north and the topography of the south. So if you go on to the next slide, you can see that, again, the same instrument, the radar instrument, was able to map the global shape of Titan. We did this by assembling together all the different altimeter passes that we had of Titan and smoothing that out and trying to solve for the global shape that best fits all the data that we had. And this is the map of the topography, the global topography of Titan that we came up with. And what you see is that blue is low, red is high. So the polar regions on Titan are somewhat lower than the equatorial regions of Titan, a puzzle that, by the way, deserves attention by itself. But you don't see a big difference between the north and the south. You see that both regions are somewhat lower, and it's not like the northern hemisphere is a lot lower than the south, for example, as is the case on Mars, where the northern hemisphere is lower, or as is the case on the moon, where the near side and the far side are so different. You see that on Titan, even though there is a dichotomy, there is a hemispheric difference in Titan in the lake distribution, the topography is not really strongly asymmetric. So it's probably not a result of the global shape of Titan that drives all the liquid to, say, flow down to the northern hemisphere. So that hypothesis was rejected. The next idea, and it's outlined on the next slide, titled Numerical Predictions, was that maybe this effect is seasonal. So now we have to talk about the seasons on Titan. This is really interesting. So Saturn, not Titan, Saturn has an orbital obliquity, a spin obliquity that's similar to the Earth. So Titan's spin pole is tilted relative to its orbit, just like the Earth is. So therefore, it has seasons. It goes around the sun once every 30 years. So the seasons are 30 times longer than the Earth, but it still has seasons comparable to the Earth. And Titan is in Saturn's equatorial plane. Okay, so I imagine an object that's tilted relative to the sun, and then another object that's also tilted because it just comes along for the ride. It is just orbiting around Saturn, and it is also tilted relative to the sun by the same amount that Saturn is tilted relative to the sun. So Titan also has seasons. They're also 30 years long, the time that it takes Titan and Saturn to go around the sun. And Titan gets a lot less energy from the sun because it is 10 times further, so it gets 100 times, I've said this several times now, 100 times less energy. But the difference in energy between the different seasons is substantial because the obliquity is comparable to the Earth. So what people thought is maybe as a result of the seasons, just like there are seasons on Earth where sometimes it rains more than others, maybe every 15 years, half of the year on Titan, all the lakes are evaporated from one hemisphere and rain down on the other hemisphere. And then the next season later, they all evaporate from the second hemisphere and rain back down on the first hemisphere. So what you see in this slide are some simulations, global circulation models that people produced. This one is from Mitchell and others, where they try to take into account the energy budget of how much energy it takes to evaporate, to heat up and evaporate methane on Titan, and predict the extent to which methane would evaporate over a Titan year. So on the right panel, you see two Titan years plotted on the x-axis. So time is running along on the x-axis from 0 to half a year to 1 year to 1.5 years and so on. And on the y-axis is latitude on Titan. So at the top of the plot is the northern pole, and the bottom of the plot is the south pole. And the colors in the plot indicate the net evaporation minus precipitation that's predicted by the model. So you see that the seasons on Titan, from north to south, predict a certain amount of energy that's available for evaporation minus precipitation that varies in time. So sometimes there's more evaporation minus precipitation, so net evaporation in the southern hemisphere, and sometimes there's more evaporation in the northern hemisphere. And that alternates between one hemisphere to the other. And the amount of energy we're talking about is a couple of watts per square meter. Does anybody on the line know how much energy the Earth gets from the sun in watts per square meter? Will my graduate students come to the rescue?
1,300?
Yeah, like 1,300 watts per square meter is how much energy is incident at the top of the atmosphere on the Earth from the sun. Titan only gets like 10 watts per square meter. So it's a lot less energy. We already said 100 times less than Earth. And of that 10, only a couple of watts per square meter go into evaporation minus precipitation. But that's what leads to the seasonal difference in terms of the volatile distribution on Titan. So the question is, can this explain why all the lakes are in the north versus the south? Maybe we just caught Titan in the season when it rains more in the north. So how much methane can you evaporate or precipitate using a couple of watts per square meter? We can divide by the latent heat of fusion of the material and get the equivalent amount of methane in meters per year, and the answer is about 30 centimeters. Okay, so with a couple of watts per square meter, you can evaporate a net amount of several tens of centimeters per year of methane. Now, why is this important? Because I already told you that the pits in the ground are a couple of hundred meters deep, and the lakes, maybe they don't fill all of the pits, but the lakes might be tens of meters deep if they occupy some of these pits. So there is, I think, with this seasonal budget, not nearly enough energy to evaporate all of the methane from the lakes in one hemisphere in one season. You can evaporate a little bit of the methane, and you can transport it from pole to pole, sure. But it's not nearly enough energy to evaporate tens of meters of worth of lakes from one hemisphere and transport them from the south to the north in the current configuration. So I think we have to reject that idea, too. And the next slide just reminds you how deep these pits are, so as I already mentioned. So let's skip that one. Okay, the last thing I'm going to talk about, I see we're running short on time here, is, I think, the right answer for why all the lakes are in one hemisphere and not the other. So if you look at the slide that shows Titan's orbit, it's a black background slide. This is a little bit tricky, so I'm gonna go slow here. You see Titan here, that's orbiting Saturn, in orbit around the Sun. Now, we already talked about the fact that the Titan and Saturn are tilted relative to the Sun, and that's why they have seasons. But in addition to that, what I didn't say is that their orbit is also eccentric. So there are times at which Titan is close to the Sun, and there are times at which it's further away from the Sun. The orbit moves around in an ellipse like this. So when it's close, it's about 9 times the distance of Earth from the Sun. That's how far Titan is from the Sun. And when it's far, it's 10 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun. But the alignment is such that in southern summer, when the southern hemisphere of Titan is pointed towards the Sun, in the direction of the pole is towards the Sun, Titan is close to the Sun. And in northern summer, Titan is far from the Sun. So there's an alignment between the eccentricity of the orbit and the seasons, the direction that the spin pole of Titan points during the year. So what results from that is that southern summers are short and intense, and northern summers are long and subdued. Now, let's see if we can understand what I just said. Why should the southern summers be short and intense? They're intense because it's a little bit closer. It's 10% closer to the Sun. So we expect the summers to be a little bit hotter. They're also a little bit shorter because as the object passes through perihelion, through the point closest to the Sun, it speeds up a little bit. So the orbital velocity is not the same at different places in the orbit, because when the object is close, it accelerates, and when the object is far, it slows down. So So the seasons, the summer is, in the south is short and intense, and in the north it is long and subdued. The average is actually exactly the same. The average amount of energy that a Titan poles get is exactly symmetric. But the peaks are different. And if you go to the next slide, the one that's titled Solar Insolation, you see on the x-axis is, again, time. This time it's measured in unit of angle, going from 0 to 360, but it's still just one Titan year plotted on the x-axis. And on the y-axis is latitude. And what you see here is that the southern hemisphere receives a lot of sunlight from the sun during southern summer. That's the contour that's labeled 7 there. That's the peak of southern summer at near 270 degrees of L sub S, the angle that measures season on Titan. So Titan gets something like 7.5 watts per square meter in peak southern summer at the South Pole. But the North Pole only gets six watts per square meter at peak. That's the contour that's labeled near the top of the plot, the top left of the plot. So as we had expected, southern summers, in the peak of southern summers, you get more sunlight in the peak of, than in the peak of northern summer, but the summer is smeared out in the north over a longer time period. So any process in climate that is sensitive to the peak, but not to the average energy, and there are many such nonlinear mechanisms in the Earth climate system, any process that's sensitive to the peak of the insolation, of the amount of energy received from the sun, could lead to an asymmetry in the amount of methane that evaporates in one pole versus the other one. Now, the really interesting thing is that this alignment between southern summer and perihelion, that's true today. But if we looked at Titan several tens of thousands of years ago, and if you go to the next slide, you'll see a movie that shows that same energy plot changing with time. If we looked at Titan several tens of thousands of years ago, the situation would have been exactly reversed. I'm going to speed up a little bit now. So if you look at the next slide, that's titled Solar Insolation, you see that if we looked at Titan 30,000 years ago, the situation was exactly reversed. So on the left panel, you see the situation today. On the right panel, you see that 30,000 years ago, northern summer received something like 7.5 watts per square meter, and southern summer was only 6 watts per square meter. So if this crazy theory of mine is right, that all the lakes on Titan are in the northern hemisphere today because of the net difference between the seasons, not because of the seasonal cycle, but because the seasonal cycle isn't symmetric. If all of that is right, then if we looked at Titan in the past, we would have expected all the lakes to migrate from hemisphere to hemisphere as a result of the orbit of Titan changing with time. The orbit of Titan changes with time for the same reason that the orbit of Earth changes with time, because all the planets mutually perturb one another. Every time they pass by, they give each other a little gravitational kick, and the whole system sort of vibrates. On the Earth, those vibrations lead to what's called Milankovitch cycles. And if you skip two slides forward, you see that the variations in sunlight on the Earth that are plotted, this is a slide that has several colorful traces on it. The variations that are plotted in yellow in the amount of sunlight that 65 North on the Earth receives are strongly correlated with the glaciation and deglaciation cycles on the Earth. Those are called that theory that links the amount of sunlight on the Earth and the amount of ice that accumulates in the pole is called Milankovitch theory for the Earth's climate change, and it is what most people now believe is they're responsible for the periodic changes in climate that the Earth experiences. What is incredible, I think, is to recognize that on Titan, the very same thing or an analogous thing may be going on, namely that variations in the orbit on tens or hundreds of thousands of years timescale, similar to Earth's, are also leading to variations in climate that are themselves leading to variations in the volatile distribution on the surface. On the Earth, the volatile is water or ice, and it moves around from the poles in the form of ice to the equator and back to the poles with tens of thousands of year time scale, and that's why we have glaciation, deglaciation cycles. On Titan, the volatile is methane and a little bit of ethane, and those two volatiles move around with various time scales on Titan from pole to equator to pole, and what may be responsible for the present distribution and concentration of methane in the northern hemisphere. So I'm going to skip the rest of the slides because we're out of time. And I'll just, if you guys can all go ahead to the summary slide. I didn't get a chance to talk about this, but I will tell you that we see the lakes on Titan changing with time, and we're actually just now publishing these changes. We can see, for example, on the bottom of the summary slide, you see two images of Lake Ontario taken at two different times, and you see that the shorelines of Lake Ontario have receded in the couple of years that we've been observing it. And the recession rate that we can measure from that is something like a meter per year. So again, not enough to explain why all the lakes are in the north now, but still large enough to be detectable by Cassini. And then ultimately, the concentration, now I'm looking at the let's see, this is slide number 48. Ultimately, the concentration of lakes in the northern hemisphere, I think, is due to an asymmetry in the seasons, southern summers being short and intense and northern summers being long and subdued. And that asymmetry in the seasons is inherited from the orbit, and that asymmetry on the orbit changes with tens of thousands of year timescale. So it may be the case that Titan experiences tens of thousands of year variations in its volatile distribution that are analogous to Earth's Milankovitch cycle. We would really love to go and test out this theory, and one of the ways in which we want to do that is by sending a spacecraft, and we just proposed this in the latest opportunity that NASA announced to send things around the solar system. So we just proposed this in the form of a lake lander, a ship, if you will. And if you could look at the last slide now, slide 50 of 50, you'll see an artist's conception of what we call the Titan Mare Explorer, the acronym for which is TIME. This is a spacecraft that we propose to send to Titan, come through the atmosphere much like Huygens did, and then splash down in a lake, in a sense, in a romantic sense, going back to how humans explored the Earth initially, that is with ships. We want to send a ship to Titan and take a little sip of the lake, measure its composition, measure the rate at which it's changing, take pictures of it, measure its depth, do as much analysis as we can to try to understand really the extent of the hydrologic cycle on Titan. So I think I'm going to quit here. I'm sorry I didn't get through all my slides, but if there are any more questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
That's great. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Professor Aronson? So,
yes, Professor.
Yeah.
This is Dave Ingram in Seattle.
Hi, Dave.
And on your depictions of the bright and the empty pits, is there an actual location on your global charts of Titan where those were actually sampled?
I didn't indicate them in the chart. If you're interested, if you send me an email, I'll be more than happy to find them for you.
I didn't know where they were or the relative scale to the depictions.
Oh, I see. They belong somewhere in that, if I'm looking at slide number 26 now. So if you look at that map, they belong somewhere in that cluster of lakes that are not the largest seas, that you see a mixture of both blue and red spots. Those are the blue ones are the filled lakes, and the red ones are the empty lakes. So that's sort of what they would look like in map view.
So dimensionally, they're intermediate-sized lakes?
Oh, I see what you're asking, how big they are. Yeah, so you see, actually, there is a scale bar near the top of that slide, so there are sort of tens of kilometers in size.
Okay.
Both of them, yes. So they're between the small and the medium-sized lakes, I would say.
Okay, so the scale of A and C are both the same scale.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for clarifying that.
Other questions?
This is Lynn again. It's a little bit off topic, but you were talking about tectonic shorelines earlier, and I was wondering if you could say something about what kind of tectonics you think this is. Do you think it's similar to what we have, or is it a different kind of tectonics?
I actually don't know the answer to that. There is no evidence of plate tectonics that I'm aware of on Titan. But there are many other tectonic processes that occur on the Earth. You know, plate tectonics is it's one very important process that explains much of what we see in the broad scale of the Earth. But, you know, the basin and range and other mountain-building processes on the Earth aren't specific to plate tectonics. So Titan may not have plate tectonics, but may still be building mountains via tectonic processes. So I don't know specifically what style of tectonics is going on Titan. It's probably not plate tectonics, but I do know that there are mountains that are abut the lakes, and I would very much guess that those mountains were raised by tectonic forces.
And something that would contribute to replenishing the atmosphere.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
This is Jason in New York. Just a quick question between the dark and the bright lake outlines.
Yeah.
In the dark ones, it's pretty clear you have these dark patches, and there's not a lot of demarcation. You just see, there's better demarcation. You see the bright patches and the clustered white. But in the bright, like the letter C, where the bright patches, I'm looking specifically at slide 18, I see a ring of dark around the bright. Would that be does that make sense that it's a depression surrounding that, or would that be trick of the angle of the radar?
I think it's the latter. I think it's a trick of the angle of the radar. I think what you're seeing here are the slopes that are surrounding the pit. So you have a steep slope and then a flatter floor in the bottom
of
the lake. And I think what you're seeing here is the radar shadow, essentially, of the steeper slopes.
All right. Cool. That's what I thought.
Good observation, though. Thanks.
When would you propose to have your Titan Mare Explorer? What's the launch opportunity?
It is in a few years. I don't remember the year. I'm sorry. I should remember this, but it's in a few years. It's actually a fairly tight schedule to build the spacecraft and get it to the Cape.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
A question on slide 42, please. Could you just go over the color coding once?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Slide 42.
Slide 42.
I'm not sure I understand the color coding.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't talk about this slide. This is actually a very interesting piece of work that that Alex did. What's going on there is the shoreline of Ontario Lacus, the feature that's shown here, is actually not completely radar dark. I told you that the lakes are almost entirely radar dark, but they're not completely radar dark. And near the shoreline of Ontario, we can actually see some of the radar energy penetrating through the liquid, bouncing off the floor of the lake, and then reemerging up through the liquid and coming back to the spacecraft. And if we look at the amount of energy that's returned from those regions, just a few kilometers away from the shoreline, we see that as we get deeper and deeper into the lake, there is less and less energy that's returned because the lake is attenuating, is absorbing more and more of that energy. So what that means is we can map out the bathymetry, or in other words, which is the topography of the bottom of the lake, as a function of distance away from the shoreline. And those colors that you see there are actually the depths of the lake that were derived from the amount of energy that's returned from the spacecraft. So the color coding is red for deep and blue for shallow, and you see that the shoreline of Ontario, or interior to the shoreline of Ontario, you go from something like 0 meters depth to 10 meters of depth as you progress into the lake.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Yeah, so what you're looking at there, by the way, is the first extraterrestrial bathymetry map of a lake.
It looks like that's going to be published, or is that in press already?
It is in press.
Okay, what publication?
This one is in JGR.
Any other questions? I'm just curious, you know, with the Cassini Solstice mission, can you think of one observation or set of observations in the next 7 years that you'd really like to have, even if it isn't a radar observation? Is there something that you think would really answer some of these questions?
Sure. So as you can imagine, what I'd really love to know is the extent to which the lakes continue to evolve with the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Do they go away completely? I don't think so. Do they go away a little bit more? Do they go away a lot more? So what I'd really love to continue to see Cassini do is to continue to observe the lakes at every opportunity we have over as long a period of time as we can. So far, we've only looked at a fraction of a Saturn and a Titan year. So if we could get through the complete cycle, maybe asking a lot, but if we can get through the complete seasonal cycle of Titan and see how the lakes in the south and in the north continue to change, I think that would really be great and illuminating for the hydrologic cycle.
So more of the same.
In a sense, yeah.
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 But, I mean, that's a major theme of the Solstice mission is seasonal and temporal evolution, so that fits
right
in. Well, some noise has just shown up outside my window, so I think maybe we better call a halt. Thank you very much, Dr. Aronson. This is really an excellent charm telecon. And just to let participants know, the December charm telecon is canceled. It always is because it's Christmas. And January is likely to be canceled as well. It coincides with the Cassini PSG meeting, and it's really difficult to get a speaker and to get my time as well because everybody's busy with that meeting. So it's likely the next meeting will be in February, but stay tuned. And again, thank you, Dr. Aronson, and we'll talk to you all in a couple months.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Nice to meet you all.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks.